Okay, ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the Dana Buckler Show. My name is Dana.
And I'm Kristen.
And we are incredibly pleased to welcome live in studio, John Travolta. How are you?
I'm good. And thank you for staying up so late for me tonight. It's 1 a.m. for anyone who's interested time. But this is where, this is my zone. From 1 a.m. till 6 a.m. is when I feel the most relaxed and the most myself.
Okay.
So you've got what I am. Without any interferences of anything.
Outstanding. Well, yeah. we're thrilled to have you on here. So
thank you.
There's a lot, of course, we want to talk about, but I think we want to start with your latest movie that came out recently, The Fanatic.
Yes.
And, you know, Kristen and I, we did an episode on it. We did a review on the film.
And your review was so specific and so utterly articulate that I thought that I could not have written that review better if I had written it myself or with the choice of words that you guys chose, because you totally got it. You totally understood what Fred and I were going for. Beyond my, you know, anticipation of how anybody could get it so well, you guys got it. And I really appreciate it.
Absolutely. So I guess the first question I have when it comes to The Fanatic is, how did you get involved with the project?
I had met Fred Durst about, you know, I'm not really sure when I first met him, but I think it was about 15 years ago. And it was at a party for Ladder 49, this movie I'd done about firefighters. And he was friends with Joaquin Phoenix and Baltazar Getty. And they all were hung together. And I had already moved here, so I wasn't really part of the Hollywood scene, but I had gone out to promote. And so Baltazar had a party and Joaquin was invited and Fred was friends with all of them. And anyway, I went there and that's where I first met Fred. And he was kind of had that kind of same reaction that Quentin had with me years ago for Pulp, where he just had been a big fan and made no was unabashed about articulating it. And I was very appreciative of it. And then not too long after that, he asked to meet with me just to talk about film and his thoughts on film. So we spent, just like I did with Quentin, we spent all night, you know, these wee hours talking about movies and his visions. And what I discovered was he was actually more about film than he was music, that he used music as a way, as a tool to find film. And anyway, he said one day, I'd love to do something, you know, with you. Years later, here we are, 2 years ago, he came to me with this piece of material. And when he talked about it on the phone, I thought, I don't know. I mean, I don't know what he can do, you know, but I know that he's a really enlightened artist, meaning he's original and he's a character and he's creative and he's genius at what he does. But does it transfer to film? So anyway, I said, I'd be glad to read it. And I was so impressed with his depth in which he wrote this character and the boldness of the turns that the character, both characters, the movie star in it and the fan took, that it seemed suddenly like something that you wouldn't think felt original. And bam, it was suddenly something I had never seen before or in this case, read before. And I said, I'm in. And he said, okay, well, we got to find some way to do it. So that was the Fred background.
And it truly was a character study, the movie. Yeah. It really was. And it dug deep.
It really did and does. And I love it. And I just feel like I understand that character maybe more than any character I've ever played. That's why I was so attracted to it, because I have had those feelings about other artists. I've gotten obsessed, but we all that are a little more have the wherewithal control our obsessions with artists, but he doesn't know how to for various reasons. But the core is how we all feel about our favorite artist or sports figure or historian or whomever. But we have that thing. And I felt like I've never been able to express that or explore that on screen. And I felt like it was the ultimate way to be able to do it.
How do you prepare for that role? How do you, I mean, like I mentioned on the episode, like I've seen you disappear in roles. Like I don't see you on screen. I mm-hmm. see the character. And I've seen that in a number of films. Never so much like I have in The Fanatic. And I'm wondering, like, how do you prepare to play that character?
Well, I prepared not unlike I do every role, which is I just break it down from my what the script tells me. The ingredients are in the script. Okay, I use that as my basic recipe. And then I add layers to it as I discover more about how I could play that. But the screenplay definitely guides you. And then, you know, when I was a kid, my mother taught acting. And she had books like Building Character and Acting is Believing and all these kinds of approach to acting. And they're very simple approaches. The old-fashioned Russian act is not a complicated thing. It got complicated with Strasberg and all these other people. But the true thing is, when you understand a character and fully own it, you become it. And you can turn it on or off in a second's notice. But only when you've arrived at completely absorbing it. You see, but you have to do the homework to get there. But the homework is not difficult. It's fun. It's the research. It's the journey of building a character. It's a blast. You know, how do they talk? How do they walk? How do they think? How do they sit? How do they feel? What's their thought process? What do they eat? What do they drink? What's their past? All those questions you can ask a character. And when you come up with an accurate enough structure for you to be able to answer them and own it, you come to this moment, and I call it the zone, where you arrived at thinking of the character. There's not anything you could ask me right now that I couldn't do in character with Moose. That's how much I know him. There's not anything you could ask me about Tony Manero, and I couldn't tell you exactly how he thought and felt, opinions, feelings, whatever. Same thing with Edna and Hairspray or in Primary Colors. It's this strange thing, but until you can actually do it without thinking, you have not arrived yet. And that's truly my feeling about acting, is that you know the moment. You think with it, it's in the zone. You can't make a mistake. You are incapable of making a false move when you've arrived in that zone. And it's magical. I could cry thinking about that moment when you know.
You've become the
it's the moment. And you go, my God, I've gotten it. Now I can't wait to play it.
And in the drop of a hat, could you just pull any character that you've done?
Pretty much. I could, depending on how well written it was and what the opportunity I got to fulfill it in a full-bodied fashion. Certain characters have a full-bodiedness to them. Others are very straightforward. The ones that are straightforward are not as interesting to me, never have been. The ones that are off-center and have something to play are much more interesting to me and always have been. Do you know, it's always been about how well you can convince another beyond a shadow of a doubt that you are that person. And if you've arrived there and you can do it, boom, you've got it made. And then the audience doesn't have to work. Yeah. They just, whoa, you've invited them in to this incredible journey that you're taking with that. And you put them at ease, and you've already at ease because you understand it. They might get uncomfortable. They might get uneasy, but they're with you. They're going to go on that journey with you. But it's your job to convince them that you are worthy of taking them on that journey.
So, John, I have to say, of all the actors out there, you are one of the only ones I can think of that's probably never been typecast in any way, because you can fully, completely immerse yourself into whatever the role is. And that takes a real raw talent. I mean, it's not one that everybody possesses. For you to be able to do that, do you attribute a lot of that to your upbringing with your mother? Like you said, she yes. taught acting and
well,
and
firstly, family. Thank you for that compliment. And yes, I do attribute it, because we had an integrity to our family's ability. For us, it was about the ability to do something. It was about the ability to play a character, about the ability to do a dance, about the ability to achieve a song. And it was measured by that more than it was something else. And so we had pride in, look what I can do and how well I can do it. So that carried over into the rest of my my life as an actor. So I never worried about being typecast because I knew I could never stay with one character. I'd be too bored. I'd probably rather do something else. You see, so it was a personal journey that the idea of playing myself every time bore the hell out of me.
Yeah.
I wouldn't know what to do. I would probably do something else, you see.
You did multiple sequels with the Look Who's Talking franchise. Mm-hmm. You played the character of Chili Palmer twice. I'm wondering, though, putting those aside.
Yes.
Is there a character that you've played that you really would love to revisit? I'm sure there's multiple characters that you've played, but is there a few that really stand out that you would love to say, you know what, I'm ready to do that again?
Well, it's 1:30 in the morning or 2, or whatever it is now, and I can be utterly honest with you, is that normally when I do one, I'm kind of been there, done that, want to move on to something different. Doesn't mean that when I watch it, I can't appreciate it in a new unit of time, but it does mean that I've kind of done that. And only when the lure became too appealing was I invited to do it again, or sometimes when I was forced to do it by contract and I had no choice, which happened twice to me. But by nature, I touch and go, you know, I give it everything I have. Your friend Jim said, and I think you agreed that when I commit to it, I play every role that as though it were the best written role, the best role I've ever had, and I commit to it. But there's something that happens when you do that. When you've committed wholeheartedly, when it's over, you're ready to let it go. You know, and you're not as interested in repetition. But that's subjective. That's only me. A lot of people can't wait to do something again, you know?
Yeah.
I kind of like to be fresh with it because it gives me something to do and an adventure. And I like just like an audience likes an adventure, I like an adventure too, do you know?
When we were speaking a few weeks ago, you know, you had mentioned to me that it's really challenging roles that you look for.
Yes.
And I'm wondering, you know, throughout your career, you know, what have been, and I say this in a good way, like what have been some of the most challenging roles that you've taken on? Like,
well, let's define the word challenging, because challenging could mean difficult. And what I would say is that the least well defined, the least well written were the most challenging, because now you are just going to make this a good product the best you can. That's challenging. But a well written role is, we have to come up with a different word than challenging, because it's delightful. You're given this gift, and now you're going to go to town. So it's not so much challenging as it is wonderful to partake in. The real challenge is mediocrity.
Interesting.
That is a booger. That's like, oh man, how do I say this? How do I do this? They haven't thought this character out. Oh my God, I've got to come up with how to do this. What am I going to do? Okay, I'll do this. And you come up somehow, and you feel like you're saving your reputation by just delivering a professional performance, something that you can't be criticized for. You're just going to do your job and do it very well because you've done the best you can with that material. But the great material is just velvet. It's just you know, you're excited about it. You can't wait to play it. You have some ideas about how you'll play it, and it becomes delicious to play.
Do you find that a role that is more unlike you as a, like who you are as a person, do you find that a role that is so opposite of that to be more challenging, or is that more the velvet? Is that more the fun
part?
That's
more the velvet.
Yeah.
The ones that are most challenging, the ones that I have to play close to my own personality, then I say, well, now you have to give me the gift of what is this guy?
Yeah.
How does he think? What does he do? How is he different than me enough to get a spin on it? You know, and great material can take you there as yourself, but I find character work helps define it. It's just a little more fun to do that, you know, with, but there's nothing wrong with a good straight role, you know, that's well written. It's just that a lot of the straight roles are not well written, and you have to make them better than they are. And that's a task, you know.
That's why they call you, probably. probably right.
Well, you know, as Brian De Palma told me years ago, we pay you for this. You know, I said, well, what do you think? This take, that take, or that take? I could do it this way. He said, pay you a lot of money. You decide what the best choice is. And it was a revelation because he gave me back my hat as an actor. He's saying, I direct, you act. Now, I hired you. 90% of my job is over as far as acting is concerned. I have another job. I have to guide the story. I've got to make this work on film, but don't tax me with your acting choices. You know, you will give me what the best choices are. And I said, yes, that's what I want to hear. I want to hear trust. Do you know that Quentin Tarantino did not have a clue of what I was doing in Pulp Fiction until it was all over? He just trusted. He said, he's shuffling around. He's talking really slow. He's slurring. He's doing all sorts of activities with his hands. It's interesting, but it's not making sense to me yet. But when he started to put the film together, he said, oh, I see. He's playing the heroine here, and this is what he's doing there. And he figured it all out, but he trusted that when he put the film together, my performance would make sense. But that's what the great ones do. They trust. Robert Altman, Mike Nichols. And you would believe how little direction they actually give you. They give you minimal direction. They give you ideas that travel through the whole scenario. And they're like this juggernaut of a little seed that builds into this explosion that helps your character. But they have to give you very little, because they already trust you 90%. Now they're going to give you a little 10% jolt here or there. But they're not over-directing you. They're not telling you how to do your job. And in turn, you're not telling them either how to do their job. And that's your respect for them.
So in Pulp Fiction, when you had, you know, you said he didn't give much direction necessarily, or that there wasn't that much of a layout of how the character was going to be initially. So in the scene when you're dancing, some of those moves are fun and they're not something you'd see typically all the time, but it translated so beautifully in the movie. Did you come up with a lot of that on the spot?
Yes, because I'm older than Quentin. So when he... Well, I'll give you the history of just that little section of the movie. When I was 8, when I was my son's age, Ben, the Twist was the biggest dance in the world. And I actually won Twist contests as a kid. Like, I would go to a fireworks and little Johnny Travolta, and then I'd be out there twisting, you know, probably too long or something and boring everyone. But, you know, the Twist is what it is. It's a twist. So he was mimicking a Godard movie where they very systematically, almost robotically, leave this kind of bar, you know, hangout, and they get up and they do a kind of robotic twist, and then they sit down. And he was fascinated with that Godard movie where the men and women got up and just did this twist. And I said, you know, the twist is great. And I not only know it well, but when I was a little boy, I won contests. But there were many other twists. There are many other dances that we called novelty dances in the day. There was, he said, well, for instance, I said, the swim.
Yeah.
The hitchhiker. The Batman, which is the Catwoman, really. I said anyway, I had like 3 or 4 other dances with it. And he said, well, cool. Let's look at them. So I showed them, and then he said, well, do you want to teach them to Uma? I said, yes, I'll teach them. They're simple. They're not complicated dances. So I did. And he said, well, what if you start with a twist, because it's a twist contest, and then I'll just call out different dances and you guys can do them. I said, sure. So he was the cameraman on it, and he did that. He called out, okay, you know, the swim. Good. Twist again. Batman. You know, he did this kind of thing. And that was suggested to him only because I grew up and I had a 10-year or 12-year lead on him, where I knew something even more than the Godard movie. I was experiencing these novelty dances that happened. So that's just a little sample of how he allowed me to help.
That's why you won the contest, probably.
Yes, you know, maybe.
With that movie, actually I have 2 questions, but the first one I have is, Quentin had just come off Reservoir Dogs, this indie hit Sundance. It was right. it was all the rage. You know, how familiar were you with him when he approached you? And then the second question I have yes. is, how did he initially explain that character to you, or was it just, here's the script, take a look and we'll talk about it?
Well, firstly, I was not familiar with Reservoir Dogs yet. So I got a call, and I was my career, no one was asking me to do high-end movies. They were asking me to do sequels. So that's how I was making my living, but it was a big hit. So I was happy that I wasn't lost in space. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. Luke is talking. So, and I liked the first one very much. So I don't know who this guy is. You know, apparently he's the hottest thing in town. Apparently he loves me. Apparently he was kind of a fanatic toward me. You know, and he wants to meet you. He doesn't know what for, but he knows that one day he would like to work with me. And I said, okay, well, let's meet him. So I met him. We stayed up all night talking. He even brought out games from my movies, like this. Believe it or not, there was a Grease game, a Saturday Night Fever game, a Welcome Back Kotter game. There was all, and they were real simple things.
Right.
And he had this fantasy of playing games with me and my going into those character while we're like a
fanatic moment for sure, right?
Yeah. And so I thought, well, I don't care. It's no sweat off my back. I think it's kind of cute that this guy, you know, likes me that much that he wants to do this. So during that evening, he said, now the sun is almost coming up now. It's that late. And oddly enough, his apartment was the apartment that I had lived in 20 years prior. Huh. And that was completely a coincidence. And I had walked in and said, you have your bathroom. It's got maroon and pink tiles over there. It's like deco. So you go there. It's your kitchen. There's your bedroom. He said, how do you know that? I said, I used to live here. So that was irony, you know. But by the time that someone's coming, he said, oh, before you go. And of course, I had not talked to him much about anything but small talk and movies and things, but not anything about working together. You know, he said, I really want to work with you. And I have two ideas in my head about them. He told me this vampire idea, which was Dusk Till Dawn idea. And I didn't have much of a reaction to it. I went, oh, cool. You know, and then he said, well, there's this other idea. And he talked about the two hitmen and one's a heroin actor. I said, oh, that sounds pretty interesting, that one. And he said, well, maybe I'll send it to you, have a read. So we're walking out. He's walking me to the car. And he said, really curious. You had no reaction to the vampire moon, but you had a reaction to the hitman. What? Why? I said, oh, it's nothing. I said, I'm just not a vampire guy. I said, I don't, like, that's not my thing, you know. The blood and the thing and the, it's fun, but it's not like something that he went, oh, okay. And he kept in mind. So now he'd already cast Michael Madsen in his mind. And at the same time, Daniel Day-Lewis and Bruce Willis and James Wood all wanted my role. And of course, I'm naive to his heat. I'm naive to what he's talking to me about. And I'm just this guy that he loves that he might want to use in something. So then I get the actual offer to do the movie. Now I got to find out what he's about. So now I rent Reservoir Dogs, and I think, wow, it's this is pretty wild, but it's very dark. And so I wasn't sure I wanted to do the movie. And yeah. It freaked everybody out. They said, you don't understand. Everyone wants to do this movie. I said, I know, but I said, I just don't know about, you know, blowing that guy's head off. And I don't know about the heroin, and I don't know. It's like, I just don't know. I played a hitman, and I told Quentin that. I said, look at Robert Altman's The Dumb Waiter, Harold Pinter. I played a hitman, a Cockney hitman. And your friend Jim just watched it, and he loved it. He had never seen it. I don't know if you had ever seen it.
I have. No, I hadn't. Yeah. He told me today that it's something I definitely need to check out, and it's I mean, top of the list.
Yeah.
Yeah, so looking forward to it. Yeah.
Saw it. I think that, you know, clinched the deal. You know, to some degree, because he saw that I could do that. But I still had to be convinced. So only because I'd seen the violence in the other one, and I thought, how's this being done? And then I finally thought, well, maybe if I played it with levity, if I, you know, I'm not Michael Madsen. I'm not dark by nature. Maybe the yin-yang of it, maybe I'll bring something to it that be different. And then I heard Bruce was doing it in I thought, well, they're, you know, not dissimilar to me. They're very light in their presence. We can play dark, but we're light by nature. So then I acquiesced, you know. But I was funny because, you know, I was being paid quite a bit to do the Lucas Terminus, and I was trying to get big dollars to play it, you know. And they said, no, this is like a little tiny movie. Nobody's getting paid. Everyone's working for minimum. But it's in, they kept on stressing how important it was and how big it would be for me. But I couldn't think with it because to me, you know, I said, this really cool dude loves me, did this really dark movie called Reservoir Dogs. And this is another dark movie that could just as easily, you know, at best be another Reservoir Dogs. And I thought, okay, it'd be cool, but I don't know how much it will do to create other work and how wrong I could be because it gave me 20 years of the first choice of any script I wanted.
It definitely opened the door to a whole nother generation. Oh, yes. I mean, there's not a generation alive today that doesn't recognize you as a huge star. I mean, then that movie
and
is
it
part
really
of it.
Was that film that I regained my, you know, and Quentin was, you know, I make it sound like a light evening, but, you know, in all due respect, he was very well versed on film criticism. He quoted my Blowout review and my Saturday Night Fever review. And he said, do you know how much you meant to Pauline Kael? And, you know, he was utterly disappointed that I did anything but grade A, you know, as, you know, Saturday Night Fever, Grease, Urban Cowboy, and Blowout. It's like, don't, you know, that's what he wanted me to do every time out. Sometimes you have the luck of the draw, sometimes you don't, but he was very tasty in what he liked, even as a young man. He was, he understood what he liked. And that evening, he was very articulate about that. But we just hadn't talked about what we would do. But we talked about film critiquing and, you know, some of my stories about my films and stuff. But it was like, you know, kind of just a sweet reflection of things in that evening. But it all ended up something big.
So was he a fan of Carrie as well?
Huge.
Yeah.
Carrie was the first thing he had seen me in. So yes, Carrie was what cemented. Carrie and Blowout were the bookends to what he loved.
It's a Quentin Tarantino bookend right there, for
absolutely.
Sure.
Carrie and Blowout, no doubt about it.
You talk to him. He pitches this idea to you.
Yeah.
You decide you're going to do it. His second feature film, you've had experience with a number of directors.
Mm-hmm.
What's it like on the set during the production of that film? Are you getting it right away? Like this, there's a reason why this guy is being dubbed the hottest director in town right now.
Absolutely, yes, because I had already worked with Altman, De Palma, yeah. Bridges, so I knew what great directing was, and he joined the club right away. So he really let you discover. I'll give you just two examples of how brilliant he was in his directing. He said, okay, I wrote this, obviously. He said, so I've heard you do it about 10 times, and I really like it. He said, it's really good. He said, but I just have a few requests. Would you hit the operative word on this and on this and on this? That's all I want. And I said, sure. So I hit the operative word and he was happy. There was three things about describing when I was in Holland and in the car, and he just wanted me to hit these notes. And the only other direction he gave me was when Marvin is in there and I'm asking him about why he didn't tell us that these guys were in the other room. And I was playing it upset with Marvin. He said, it's good. I believe it. It works. He said, it's fine. He said, but do one take for me where you just are just genuinely curious, but don't be upset or mad at him. Just be, hey, why did this happen? Like, what? Why would you do that? You know, just curious. And the brilliance about it was when they put the movie together, because if I had been mad at him, you'd have been certain that I blew his head off. Because I was upset with him. But because I wasn't upset with him, you go, well, did he do it on purpose? Was it covert? Was it like this? And I play it so innocently, which is hilarious.
Yeah.
But if I had played it upset, it would have changed the whole color of that section, which is kind of a brilliant set piece.
You never do see it coming. That's a, you know.
You never see it coming. Because why would it now? he's, when he does it, he's talking philosophically about, did God come down and, you know, all this? And it's genius. But do you see, he left it alone until something was very important to the storytelling, which is exactly what Mike Nichols would do in Primary Colors. He asked about operative words hitting operative, because there's a rhythm that writers like to hear the words. And sometimes they imagine it hitting those notes and they want it like that. And that's not a big deal to ask for an actor. You can be in character. You could ask me in Moose Land to hit an operative word and I'd go, sure. You know, that's not a big deal. So those are interesting tidbits of great directing, where you want to see someone make a mess of it. You'll see a mediocre director over-direct everything. More energy. This and that. And then they're all over. And the actor's going, they're spinning because they don't know what the director wants. They have too much input, too many directions, too many contradicting directions. You know, wait a minute. You know, you'd say, the dialogue doesn't lead me there. So please change the words, but don't ask me to be angry on a word that's not an angry word.
It's like recognizing the point that it's more important to the story to make the change, I think. And that's very neat.
And without naming directors or movies, you've experienced that.
Yes.
Okay.
I've experienced that. And right away, I die inside because I know what journey I'm going to be on. I'm going to be on a journey of mediocrity. And I'm going to do my best to be as professional as I can, but I'm going to have to work at that. There was another story that reflected it beautifully. One time, and this is, again, admiring Quentin's genius, but no one was questioning the script at all, and I only questioned like a few lines and maybe most a paragraph. And I said, this isn't working for me. I can't do this. He said, why? He said, there's nothing. I said, Quentin, you're an actor. Try it. If you try it, and I hear, I'll just imitate you, but you try it. And he said, okay. So he goes, you know what? You're right. I'm going to fix this. So he went and he fixed it because he was an actor and he could, as Mike Nichols was an actor. Yep. And I think Robert Altman was too. In other words, there was actors that understood that sometimes dialogue needs to be honed for the character or just rhythms. Sometimes things that are fun to read are not fun to say. And the wrong word is fun, easy. Sometimes it's easier to say words if they're written in a certain way. And a good writer, director can fix that.
So I have a question for you, just to kind of shift gears just for a moment here. A few years ago, you were preparing for a role and you were working with the local lineman. You were with the,
yes.
And that really sort of sparked this interest in me to sort of ask you, what are some other things that you did to prepare for certain roles? Because I remember that was all around town that you were working with the lineman.
Yeah.
You spent some time with them.
Yeah, you gotta do it.
What was sort of the most fun thing that you did preparing for any particular
role? Well, the hardest.
Role? The hardest was
the linemen. They do not have an easy job, and I respect the hell out of them because I became a lineman and I became a fireman in order to understand that. And you do it to the degree you need to do it. But I really did go to fire school for almost a month. All of us did. And I did everything except I was limited on the black box. I didn't like that feeling in there. So I came out early on that. But other than that, I did everything I was supposed to do to graduate from fire school. And the lineman stuff, I did everything I needed to do as asked to do the script. But by far, they were the most difficult. They were, you know, you had to, in order to become them and play them properly on screen, I felt those were challenging in a physical way that you could hurt yourself or hurt another, let's say. As far as intriguing, when I did the Killing Season with Robert De Niro, going to Serbia and Bosnia, yeah, and talking to these guys about and hearing them talking, I was recording everything they were saying, and I had three different Serbian instructors, and I noticed the difference in their accents and tried to do a combination that would speak to everything. And that was the most adventurous role as far as really diving into the psyche of these people that had the most horrid war,
yeah,
and the most politically incorrect war other than Vietnam, where it was so clear that it was other countries that were prompting the war between Bosnia and Serbia, that it was tragic. But to see these guys who had recovered from it, but there's still blood on the walls, literally, in restaurants and things and whatever, and you're going, wow, and now they're in Izod shirts and they're, you know, and you go, these poor people, what they've gone through. So the reason I went further in that role than I did others as far as research by going there is because Bobby De Niro was the first actor that taught us that in order to be utterly effective, you should really do research. And he did it for New York and New York. He played the sax. He did it for Raging Bull. And it got us excited as young actors, because I'm about 11 or 12 years younger than Bobby. But I was at the age where I was, well, I grew up. My mother was in acting as believing, building a character. Yes, I know how to do that. But then there's this next level of going into research so deeply that you can own it. And that was the most adventurous role as far as research and prepping. And the rest had to do with, you know, like the civil action was research in law. Primary colors, I had really never understood the structure of Congress and Senate and all that. So I did a whole schooling on, I thought, if I'm going to play a president, you better freaking know the structure of our country and how the system works for voting, how things get passed, because I think at minimum our presidents know that.
Sure. Did you watch a lot of Schoolhouse Rock for that? But
well, so that was an adventure. But there's not a role that, you know, other than the simple ones like Phenomenon or Lucas Talking, where there wasn't much to research. Sure. That didn't take some research. Even Saturday Night Fever, I spent 6 months hanging with these young people at the discos and studying that solo dance. I studied for actually 9 months, worked on that. Do you know? So from the beginning of my movies, I've always done in-depth research, but to varying degrees, and some's more fun than others.
So I have to ask, when you did Face Off, you know, with Nicolas Cage, and the research that you had put into doing that part with him.
Mostly each other.
Yes, yeah. Very much. Yeah. So, I mean, was that fun? I mean, I would hope that would have been a fun thing.
Well, it was scary to us because we didn't know, because Nick and I really don't physically look like her. And I said to John Woo, I said, how do we do this? You know, I'm heavier than Nick. I'm bigger, bigger frame. I said, we don't really look like, how are we going to pull this off? And then suddenly I got this idea that Nick is so specific in his walk and his talk, that if I can absorb that, the rest will disappear. And he justified things with tummy tuck and what the doctors were talking about will get him like this. So by the time I was, you know, supposed to be Nick, I had him down so well that nobody worried. Again, if I'm confident in playing, you know, Nick talking like this and, you know, that, and I walked the way he did and all that, then you're already there. You know, it's like, oh, okay. I don't care about the details of, you know, if he's a little heavy or whatever. He's Nick, you see. So that was the key to that. So what we did is I would watch Nick's dailies and Nick would watch my dailies, and we learned from, and sometimes we'd choose together. I said, what do you want to do? I have to say something. And I told him a story about, I don't know, Warren Beatty or something, where he was describing a peach. And so he said, oh, I love that. Nick said, I love that. He said, maybe I'll do that in the plane. I'll describe a peach. And I said, and then I'll repeat it later. So we made choices together that we would reflect with each other throughout the thing. And he had a harder time of it because he couldn't find again who I was. He said, I watched everything. He said, who are you? I can't find you. I said, well, if you look at Lucas Talking and Phenomenon, he said, yeah, but there's still nothing that's really you on screen. He said, and it's a tribute to you. He said, but I'm having a tough time with this. I said, well, that's why we have to watch each other's dailies. And you get an education on when I'm playing Sean Archer, what I'm going to do. And then you just try to do that. And, you know, you're easier to do than I am, but I'll just do, and we'll choose together how we structure this piece. And that's how we did it, you know?
That's incredible. That really is. Really, you know, I've seen the movie 10 times, but to have you sort of break it down like that, like, because it's seamless. It's seamless on screen. Like, you both do it so well that I didn't even think about the amount of work.
And I said to Joan Allen and Nick at one point, I said, is this working? This is such a risky thing. I have no idea if this is working. And Nick said, I really think it is. I really do, John. And then Joan, who I thought, okay, well, Nick, he's a dreamer like I am, and I don't know if he knows for sure. So I said, Joan, who's ultra conservative in her. She's not, you know, feety about her thinking. She's very real. So I said, Joan, is this working? And she said exactly what Nick said. John, I really think it is. I think this is working. And I breathed, you know, I just didn't know. But when they had confidence, and John, who spoke very little English, I was trusting because he's so good that it was working, but I didn't know for sure. And when they thought it was, then I thought, well, maybe it is. And it did.
It certainly did. Yeah. It
certainly did.
Yeah. Are you and Nicolas Cage still friends? I mean, are you friends? Is that something? Well,
if I saw Nick, we would, you know, I can, yes.
So does he try and imitate you when you guys see each other and you guys?
No, we haven't gotten to what we're really doing in person, but he is a character. He's a very delightfully eccentric man, do you know?
Yes.
And he blames me for introducing him to the good life, which a lot of other big actors blame me for, because I'm a little unabashed about it. You know, I don't mind enjoying the art of life as much as I do the art of acting and filmmaking. So I think that I try to encourage them to enjoy their life, you know, and Nick did it. Maybe even took it too far. I don't know.
We're talking about Face Off, and, you know, you've always played such a dynamic, quote unquote, bad guy in a lot of movies. And I'm just thinking of the other ones, Broken Arrow and Swordfish, Taking of Pelham 1-2-3. I mean, any of those really stand out as far as like having a lot of fun just playing those characters?
I enjoyed Taking of Pelham 1-2-3 because Tony Scott really allowed me to be a badass. Like, he just invited it. Even where he had to fight with a studio over my choices. There's a few lines in there that the studio said, he can't say that. You know, he can't, it's too much. It's too far, you know. And he said, fuck off, you know. And he's an English guy and he would protect my performance. But I felt the freest in Pelham because he was the most psychotic out of all. I mean, not that they weren't all to some degree, but I felt like he was the most, you know, lost it guy. But it was fun because I had no rules. I could play or do whatever I pretty much wanted, you know.
I wrote down the name of a couple movies, a few of your movies.
Sure.
And I was just kind of curious. I wanted to just kind of name a movie, and you sort of just tell me the first thing that pops in your mind.
Okay.
Blowout.
First thing. Now, let's define thing.
Memory. First memory.
Memory. Of Philadelphia winter. I'll just give you words that are cold. It was the movie that I felt like I had arrived at a new level. So I was feeling very confident in my career. I had Saturday Fever, Grease, and Urban Cowboy under my belt. So I had this kind of new level of confidence in what I was doing.
Okay. Yeah. Get Shorty.
Get Shorty. Again, a new level of confidence because I'd just come off Pulp Fiction and I was with Gene Hackman and I was with the big boys, you know. I was finally getting to be in movies with people that I, you know, admired and were very serious artists and playing ball with me. So I felt very, very good about that.
Look Who's Talking.
Let's see. Well, meeting Kirstie was a revelation because we got along so well and we had so much fun that when I think of Look Who's Talking, I just think of fun. We would make each other laugh on screen, off screen. It brought me to a new reality about being comfortable on screen, being close to myself. That was the first role, really, that I had where I was okay with playing something near me. He wasn't exactly like me, but he was enough near me because she allowed that. And Amy Heckerling, they just let me be this kind of low-key cool guy that, you know, and it was comfortable.
Well, there, actually, I have a question about that. The character in that movie, was he originally in the script a pilot, or was that something
I added that.
Okay.
Because I, you know, my manager produced that movie and raised the money for it. And Amy, you know, she threw that in, yeah, as part of the development.
Okay. Awesome. Awesome. Yeah. So, Carrie.
Carrie, I felt... I don't know if you know this about my prior history, but Carrie was important to me for a reason that you'll understand after I tell you this earlier story. There was a movie called The Last Detail with Jack Nicholson, and it was between me and Randy Quaid. We'd both screen tested for it, and the director was hell-bent for me, as was the casting director, to do it. But at the last moment, they said, we want someone who, when we... looks more, just is more the guy, but you act the guy really well. And we're confused about, do we go with the guy who's acting it, or do we go with the guy who kind of is it? And they went with the guy who is it. But anyway, I was so close to getting that role and then ended up getting a nomination that I had made this mark in Hollywood about that I would be a film actor, not just a stage actor. And so this, there was this kind of thing, and I was utterly disappointed, but it didn't work out. So then I did 2 years of Broadway and came back to Hollywood. And the same casting director for that movie put me in Welcome Back, Kotter. But I was in a TV series. I wasn't in a movie. I came to Hollywood at 18, supposed to be in a movie with Jack Nicholson and nominated for an Academy Award. What happened? You know, this is like, you know, so it seemed backwards to me. So I get a call to audition for Brian De Palma in this movie based on a book that's a bestseller, Stephen King, very kind of high-end horror picture. And so my ability to improvise became so keen from Kotter that I was just killing it in the screen test. And De Palma was saying, who is this guy? Like, you know what? And I was so timid to say I was on a TV series, because in those days, I thought if you said you're on TV, you could never go into movies, some kind of false rule. Anyway, the word got out, and he said, I want to see that show. So he says, why would you ever be him? You're great in this. He said, that helps us. I'm glad you're in that show. Mm-hmm. So I feel like I regained my movie, you know, position with Carrie, because it's a studio picture, and it's a good big one. It's just basic. Piper Laurie, we even got... you know, they got two nominations. I mean, it was a, you know, for a horror picture, that was a big deal. Then I auditioned while I was on Kotter for Days of Heaven. And Terrence Malick was the Quentin Tarantino of that day. And he fell in love with my screen test. And he wanted me desperately to be in Days of Heaven. And Michael Eisner and the people of Wolper would not let me out of Kotter to do Days of Heaven. So I'm depressed because my second big opportunity, Carrie was, I'm back in the game, but Days of Heaven was going to be, I'm really back in the game. But a month later, Saturday Night Fever came on my plate, which was even a better choice as far as the longevity is concerned. So I never lost aim on the film because I was promised this from The Last Detail. And that's kind of the brief version. There's a lot of stories I could tell you about Terrence Malick and why he didn't. He was so heartbroken about my not being able to do that, he didn't do a movie for 17 years. And when I did The Thin Red Line with him, I said, Terrence, be honest with me. You know, I know you're utterly a romantic, but what, did you really give up movies for seven because I couldn't do Days of? He said, yep. I was stunned by that truth. I said, but why? Because I was heartbroken too. But I had been heartbroken about Last Detail. I mean, so I knew how to get over it. He didn't.
That's incredible.
Killed him. And he said, I could not believe that it would take so little of rescheduling for you to do my movie and that all the powers to be would not allow it to happen. He said, it crushed me and I didn't want to be part of anything that wouldn't allow something that was no reason to block it. To me, I didn't want to be in a business that could do that.
Why did that happen? Why was that just like, why were you prevented from doing that? What was the justification that was given to you?
One that I didn't believe, But it was, we just, you know, we can't afford. I said, well, I'll take a Learjet up to Canada and I'll be back. No, it's too weird. What if you didn't get here in time? And what if they just had, if I wore a polka dot tie, it would have been the reason why I shouldn't do Days of Heaven. The truth is, it was in the days where if you became a movie star, you would leave and abandon that TV show. And they didn't want that. Farrah Fawcett had done it the year before, and they were really miserable about that. And another big star had done it, and it was a popular thing now to become a big TV star and now abandon the show. Well, they weren't taking any chance because I was their golden boy on Welcome Back, Kotter. So they would not allow that. And by the time I got offered Saturday Night Fever, Robert Stigget said, we're going to do these movies on your hiatus. It's not going to interfere with anyone. The problem with Days of Heaven is they couldn't wait till my hiatus. They were starting the same week Kotter was starting. They would have had to wait 5 months, and they couldn't do that. So, but if they had started 3 months earlier, or they'd been willing to wait till March, I could have done it. But they couldn't, and Kotter didn't want to. Nor would they. And Michael Eisner later apologized to me. He said, you know, I have to apologize because I knew I could have let you out and I didn't because I was being selfish about what we needed and I could have worked. I guess I was worried you would go off or something. And he blocked it. So that was that. But, you know, then I wouldn't have done Saturday Night Fever. I wouldn't have done Grease. I would have had a whole different career. And, anyway,
the stars align, and
yeah, and every there's room for everybody. You know, you get Tom Hanks had a good career for me saying no, and Richard Gere had repeatedly a career from my saying no, and you know, there's a lot of people that benefited by my saying no. You know, and I'm fine with that. You know, because I like what I've done.
The next movie I have on my list is one that I've actually done an episode on my podcast. Mm. I'm a big fan of Primary Colors. It's one of my favorite movies that you've ever been in.
Thank you. So
that's the next one on the list. You know, Primary Colors. I mean, like for you to talk a lot about it if you could.
Primary Colors. Okay. Well, let's see. I'll take you from the start. I hear that Mike Nichols is interested in my playing Primary Colors, is a veiled Clinton character. So I said, well, I love Mike Nichols. And the odd thing about it is my old manager, the first one, said, the people that are mediocre are not going to like you, John. But the great ones, like Mike Nichols, are going to love you. And here it is. Now my first manager is long gone. And Mike Nichols is going to come to the set to see me. And my manager said that that would happen one day. 20 years, I was 16 when he told me that. So here I am meeting with Mike Nichols, and I meet him as Jack Stanton, or Clinton in my case. I said, Mike, how you doing? Come on in. Would you like a cup of coffee? I admire your work. I think you're a great filmmaker, and I'd love to talk to you about playing this character. And well, he said, oh my God. You know, and he was very dramatic. And he was very thrilled with my, you know, diving in and, you know, because he's audacious. Mike was very, very, you know, theatrical and, you know, we had the same kind of background. Well, we were off and running and we did it. And every day was a joy. He was an extraordinary. And Elaine May was his partner on that movie. So she was like mom, he was like dad. So if I had a problem with dad, I'd just go to mom. So dad, Mike would say, well, I don't, you know, I think you should just say what's written. And I think I don't want to say what's written. Elaine, can I talk to you for a minute? Mike says that I have to say this on. Do you think that Mike, if John doesn't want to say the line, don't make him say the line. Okay, fine. And he'd give in. So it was this system I had with the two of them. But his confidence in you, that's why I said the common through line is confidence, was so powerful. If you worked with Mike Nichols, he assumed you were royal family and he treated you like you were royal family, period. And even though you felt like you weren't, you were Hollywood royalty to him and he treated you as such. John, are you ready to end the day? I said, well, I kind of. He said, wrap. You know, he was so into the artist being very safe to create, never nullify their choices or make less of their choices. Trust in your choices. And again, I think I got one direction, which was hit these operative words. And it was at the urinal when I'm, you know, he's saying, could you say, we're all, you know, just hit all. And if you look at the movie, you could see me hit all. It's like the only direction. And he trusted this on this up this level. Think of what, oh, and then I would, because he's a comedian and Elaine May's comedian, I would come as different movie stars each day to entertain him. And I'd be Vava Stanwyck one day. I'd say, hello, Mike. Oh, Barbara, you're here. Well, how's your day? I don't like it at all. Now you get out. All of you, get out of here. All of you. My Barkley boys are good boys. You know, I would do, you know, and he would get laughing and Elaine would laugh and, you know, and then next day I'd be Joan Crawford, you know, do some bit as Joan. And he just loved playing. He's a playful, funny man, but dead serious about good work. When Billy Bob Thornton and I were really like kind of disrespectful to other people's methods, because we were the kind of actors just assume the beingness and become it. Kathy Bates needed a little prep time. She wanted maybe 15 or 20 minutes of getting into the zone. There's nothing wrong with that. But we were behaving like children. And he yelled at us. He said, you guys, he said, come here, both of you. He said, you have to respect her technique. Just because it's not your technique doesn't mean that you shouldn't give her space to do it. And we were like dogs with her. And I thought, he's absolutely right. I mean, we're just assuming that, well, we're fine, you know. So that, well.
What was his favorite impression that you did?
I think maybe it was Stanwyck. I don't know. I forget. There's three or four of them I did. Once I got my laugh, you know, I just would let it go. It's like my idea was make Mike laugh today, you know?
With the character of Governor Jack Stanton, and the movie came out 97, 98, right in that time area. Clinton's president at the time. I mean, what was sort of going through your mind when you're doing this character, knowing that, you know, it's right. This, like I said, a thinly veiled version of President Clinton.
I was fond of him as a president, and I, because I'm not political. I have no, you know, claim to anything other than I do what I feel is right, you know, but I liked him. And I even met him, and he helped me with one thing that I needed personally. So I wanted to be respectful and caring toward him as well. And I think I was, but we did play what we played. And the odd thing was we were supposed to say we weren't playing. Then I said, oh, please. I'm on the cover of Time magazine in Bill Clinton getup, you know? And I didn't lie. I was the only one that didn't say, I said, yeah, I'm playing. So the cover of Time magazine, you can look up and says, yep, he's Bill, you know, because I just find it peculiar to like kind of tell untruths when they're so obvious. You know, I remember the Academy went through something where we were supposed to pretend that we were guilty of certain, you know, behavior that I didn't agree with. I said, we can all say I feel that way when I don't, you know? And then I was told, they said, well, no, that's the protocol. You do that. I said, but it's so blatantly not true. So I felt in that case, it was blatantly not, you know, that I was doing what I was doing, you know? So I didn't feel like I should lie.
Did President Clinton ever comment on your performance to you?
No, but he was beautifully friendly. Yeah. I saw him three or four more times, and I'll write him a birthday card. He writes me a birthday card. And, I thought he has a very global perspective on things, very rational perspective on things, and very much respected both parties. I didn't think he was a separatist at all, you know, and that's why I liked him.
So the next movie on the list is one I know that Kristen really wanted to talk about, and that's Michael.
Mm.
I love that movie.
Michael's a wonderful movie. When I think about that movie, I think about the joy of, again, being... That was the one I felt most free being a good guy. Like, I felt most free in Pelham because there were no barriers on how bad he behaved. With Michael, I could be free within the eccentric behavior. And thankfully, Nora let me do that. I was so afraid she wasn't going to. That scared me more than anything. And then when I did the choices I chose, and she accepted them, I thought, okay, now I'm going to be able to do whatever I want. And so I went wherever the day brought me, and I was free to be Michael the way I imagined he would be. Because I said, oh, he drinks, he smokes, he eats sugar, he has sex. It's like he does whatever he wants, you know, but he does it with love and regard and not hurting anybody. And she allowed me to be odd in it.
Yeah. Was that written into the script with the smoking and the free? Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, it was such a delightful character to play.
Yeah.
You know,
I loved Nora Ephron. I loved her.
But in all fairness to, that's my favorite Nora Ephron movie.
Yeah.
By far.
Oh, yeah.
Because I felt it had real humor and it was different.
It was.
Have you ever seen a movie like Michael?
No.
No.
And that's one of the things I love about it is how different and heartfelt.
When I come down that staircase, you know, I look like an out of shape gladiator, you know, because you could see still some muscle, but it was all, you know, a layer of fat with it. And with those big wings and smoking and not quite awake, I mean, it's just fodder for an actor. You know, scratching my balls and then eating the cereal backwards.
Yeah.
And letting it drip. I mean, it was so odd and wonderful, you know, and fun. You know, Gene Stapleton was so cute in it. Mm-hmm. I loved it. I loved being in that movie. Love that opportunity to play that character. That was a joy.
Okay, next one I had was Urban Cowboy. Because you know, we got it.
Urban Cowboy. Yeah. Oh my God, it was a very important part of my life because I had done 6 super successful things. Boom, Welcome Back, Kotter. Boom, Carrie. Boom, Boy in the Plastic Bubble. Boom, Saturday Night Fever. Boom, Grease. And then I do this movie called Moment by Moment, which gets beat up.
Yeah.
So now I'm crushed because I say, well, what did I do wrong? And the funny thing is the New Yorker, I don't know if you saw it, but recently did a read. They said the movie we shouldn't have complained about. And it because I've had the woman's movement and it would have been a big hit today, you know, but then it wasn't as prominent. So, I mean, the woman's movement was, but no one wanted to see it as much as they do today. So anyway, I was suffering from that and I thought, it's over. Can't believe it's over in one movie. How can it be over? But it's over. And I get a call saying that Jim Bridges, who did China Syndrome,
yeah.
And the college one, the Paper Chase, is interested in you doing this movie called Urban Cowboy about, you know, a farm guy goes to the city and has to change life. I said, really? For real? They said, yeah, it was in Paramount and it was a big offer. And I thought, well, nothing's really, you know, wow. Not only is it a big offer, but it's like nothing bad happened. And it's a character. They're asking me to play a cowboy. They're asking a New Jersey boy who is very good at playing New York and other things, but they're asking me to play a cowboy. That's going to be maybe hard for some people to swallow, but how much fun for me. So then I went to town with my research, and I started riding bulls, and I started riding mechanical bulls, and I started riding horses, and I started dancing country western dance. I started prepping, and I did 6 months of prep on that movie. So by the time they said action, I was raring to go. And loving every second of it. Every second of Urban Cowboy, I loved making. Those are my favorite experiences making a movie.
No kidding.
Yeah.
No kidding.
So did you ride the bull in the movie then?
Oh, hell yeah. Oh, yeah. I was good.
You could still ride a bull?
Probably. It's built into, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, not that I need to.
The big bar in that movie.
The Gillies.
Gillies.
Yeah.
I mean, Did you guys spend a lot of time there when you're not shooting there? Like, behind the scenes like that?
Sometimes after work or on a weekend, you know, I get introduced to Boilermakers there, you know, which is a shot in a thing. And I wasn't a big drinker, so I had to be careful. You know, one or two of those and I'm done. But I fell in love with – I learned what a real party is about in Houston. It's not about looking over your shoulder to see who's more interesting to talk to. It's about this and about having fun. There's a picture of me with a rooster and a bottle of beer, and I have my hat on, and I'm just into the joy of having fun at this party. And I said, wow, I really had fun. You know, 'cause you go from New York parties where you're not communicating to anybody. You're just communicating to someone over someone's shoulder, and you're just kind of die inside because you're not really achieving any kind of fun. There, you're achieving fun. Like, you're ready to have fun.
And that's a real connection.
A real connection. It was so great.
So I have to ask you about 2004's The Punisher, because that was a comic book film before the comic book film happened.
And it was before the boom.
And it was R-rated. And it didn't hold back. And it was a movie I saw twice in the theater in one weekend. Like, I just love that movie. And
I love that movie
to be
too.
Able to talk to Howard Saint, right? And it's incredible. So
well,
tell
I'm
me a little bit
you
about
on that, buddy, because I'm not a big Marvel comic guy, you know, and never have been. And that's not a criticism. That's just interest level. But when that came on my plate, I said, oh, this is different. This is real. And this is fun and off track and odd. And he's wickedly quiet and this is cool. I could do something with this. So they were shocked when I said yes to it, because I was still doing films. You know, I wasn't the lead in this, it was a sporting role, but it intrigued me. I said, no, I want to do The Punisher. Really? I said, yes, really. I want to do The Punisher. I like that character. I like the movie. It's well written. This director has a vision. I like his vision. I said, yeah, I'm going to do it. So I took a reduction in pay and I showed up and had a blast. I mean, when he, you know, I like that offbeat thing. And they said, well, where's your wife? I said, she took the train. You know, those crazy lines, you know, and his approach, paranoia, was so much fun to play. So, yeah.
All right. That's excellent. That's awesome.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. I'm having kind of a surreal moment right now because I remember how much I just loved that movie. Like, it was very rare that I will go see a movie twice in one weekend, but that's how much I enjoyed that film. So,
you know, I just love you because you and Jim are like my heartbeat. When I hear you guys talk about me and my choices, you make my whole life right, because there's a lot of agreement and disagreement on my choices, but you guys understand and understood. That's when I heard this first podcast. I said, I can't believe these guys. It's not just that they agree with what I've done, but they understand whether they like one movie better than another, or they understood every move I've ever made. Where do you get that kind of understanding? You don't. So you guys won me over it. You know, after that interview the two of you did, I said, this is amazing. And then after your review of The Fanatic, I said, these guys are on me like white on rice. Mm-hmm. I don't even have to be concerned about, oh, will they understand it? They've already understood it, everything I've done, beautifully. And even the historical aspects, you know, when you guys say, well, you have to understand at the time, this was happening and that was happening. Yeah. And this is what was happening in the business. And, you know, and like when Jim said, well, when he did Moment by Moment, that wasn't a bad choice. And the funny thing is, Jim, I should tell him, should read that review in New Yorker. He said, Lily Tomlin was like considered a artiste. She was. She was the biggest, like the talk of the town. And John had just done Saturday Night Fever, and he was the talk of the town. That was kind of a cool match. If we had been smarter at considering the moral code, we would have done a comedy. But she wanted to do this melodrama, which would be better now than it would have been then. But the idea that it was understood, just, you know, along with 50 other things you guys understood about my trajectory, blew me away. I just couldn't believe how impressed I was with just how clarified you were on everything. And the both of you, that review of The Fanatic, I just sent it over. I said, okay, these guys, these two, got it. They understood everything about it. And Fred was so excited, you know, and it was
an excellent film.
Yeah, thank
you. It was done extremely well. And to be able to be so absorbed into a character, and while watching it, to have that world come to life.
It was dynamic because one of the themes that her and I, as soon as the movie was over, one of the themes that her and I kept talking about before we recorded that episode was how your feelings towards the two characters continue to shift.
Yes.
You empathize with Moose.
Yes.
Then you're like, whoa. And then you're back empathizing and you empathize with Hunter. And it was a roller coaster of back and forth. And I mean that in a great way. Like it was really.
And I not only agree with you, but that's what entertainment should be. It should put you on an emotional roller coaster of some sort. And I just thought it was a bold piece of entertainment. You know, we weren't even. We didn't really even have a message of any sort, but there's 100 messages in it.
Yeah.
And The Fanatic is so different from so many movies that you see today or any time because of the way they have that back and forth between the characters that's so unique.
Exactly.
And that's one of the things I love the most.
Yeah, me too. Me too. When I read it and when we did it, and you know, that boy, Devin, I can't even imagine anyone else in this but him. Because when we were thinking, oh, should it be Arnold Schwarzenegger? Should it be Stallone? Should it be, you know, some, you know, how? They thought, no, it's got to be this other guy. And who is it? And then I had worked with Devin in the Lineman movie. And I said, Fred, indulge me. Look at this guy. And tell me if you don't think he wouldn't even be better than all the big names we've stated. Because he looks like Steve McQueen. He looks like a big movie star, and then the humor of the kind of movies he did, which aren't what he wanted
Idle
to
hands
do.
Yeah. And he has that. John, I have to say, I can't picture a better actor choice for that role because he does have such a likable history. I mean, he's in Now and Then. He's in Casper, the Friendly Ghost, you know, and his history with that. And then to see him as an adult in this film and to see that mean side is something you don't see
his
from
anger.
Him.
Well,
and
it was his fierce. Anger, honestly, was the most authentic anger I had ever felt another actor give on screen. I mean, man, when he went there, he went a 10 red, you know, and it was so easy for me to respond to that because it was so assaulting to my awareness when he did it that I could just easily access a reaction. It's beautiful. And also, I liked that he had that thing that Newman or McQueen, the thing that everybody could, you could understand why my character has a crush on him. You understand it. You go, well, he's Brad Pitt. He's everybody's, you know, you're not confused by the allure at all. Where if it had been someone else, you go, you know, why? And you go, no, especially when I see him the first time, that kind of, you know, deer in the headlights look that I give to him, I'm just, can't believe it's him and my fantasy of his going, come here, look at this. You know, it's so right on the money.
And he looks great. I mean, he must work out. He looks good.
No, he looks fantastic.
When we're done recording, I have a question about the ending of the film. I want to keep it, we'll keep it completely spoiler free during this recording. Question for you regarding Poison Rose.
Yeah.
Okay. Your daughter's in that.
Absolutely.
And phenomenal performances across the board in that film.
Yeah.
Love that movie.
Thank you.
Love it. What's her trajectory looking like as far as getting into the acting business?
Well, this is a very cool question because right now at this time of my life, I just want my kids to have a wonderful career in show business and whatever kind of movies they want. They don't need to take everything that comes their way because, you know, it's like, did Jane Fonda have to do that? She had Henry Fonda. So I like the idea that they're kind of set and they can be choosy and discerning about what they do. And Ella is not of this gen. She's an old school, gracious. She's Grace Kelly. She's Elizabeth Taylor. She's otherworldly and always has been, even when she was 8 years old. She's had this graciousness. I remember we did Old Dogs and Ellen, the talk show host, said, well, Ella, you're 8 years old, or maybe she's seven. I remember it was one or the other. And she said, what should I ask you? And Ella, I thought, oh no, Ella, what's Ella going to say? I'm more nervous than Ella. And she said, well, Ellen, it's your show and you're welcome to ask me anything that you'd like. And I thought, my God, this is so sophisticated. She gave Ellen her job back.
So gracious.
Yes. And Ella is just this unique freak of nature, which the great ones are. And I think she can have a phenomenal career.
Yeah. Well, and in The Poison Rose, she does. She has such a finesse. And,
doesn't she?
Yeah.
And it's and different. You don't see
lovely.
It anymore.
You don't. From a young actress, you don't see don't that see finesse. It. You don't see that and just eloquent
it,
way.
It was yes. It was old dogs to Poison Rose,
yes,
right?
Like,
there was nothing in between.
She wanted to be a kid. The truth was that we'd overdone it with over. She had more days of work than I did on that movie.
Okay.
She had 9 weeks of work. And for a kid that's never acted before, that was too much. So I think she literally was burned out. She took 8 years off. And was she's just like she did when she was a little girl, said, "Dad, I'm ready to do a movie." She said to me, "I think I'm ready to do a movie." I said, "Okay." And just like it was when she was little, it happened again. A week later, Poison Rose came on, and I said, "My God, you got to read this. You're perfect for this." And I was right in that crew to watch. You know, you're a father, so you think, "Oh, my daughter is all that. But to watch the crew respond to her identically to the way I was really breathtaking to watch. And they all, her first scene I wouldn't have given to Meryl Streep. 4 a.m, she'd waited till 2 p.m, and she had to cry and get angry and use a gun and drink whiskey. And I thought, this isn't even fair. And I thought, but I can't like make a special thing for her. So I let her do it, and I was so proud that she could pull it off, and everyone applauded because it was her first scene in the movie.
Well, it really validates her talent as an actor. I mean, she's fabulous.
Yeah, thank you.
Does she come to you for the acting lessons throughout the year? Yeah. Okay.
And I know when to leave Ella alone. It's trust. You know, say, "Ella, it's great, but now do this. Throw this away, throw that away, and add that." Matter of fact, Let's become the character with this one. I said, "Let's put your hair in a Gibson." She put her hair in a Gibson thing. I said, "Let's go to mommy's closet and get you a shirt that looks kind of from 1890s, you know. So let's get you we have an antique cup that's probably from that year. Let's use it. So let's own this. Let's become this." Boom. She did. Yeah, I'm sure you won't believe it.
I'm looking forward to seeing that. It's going to be awesome.
Yeah.
So what can we look forward to with you? What, you have some projects coming out that we should be looking forward to?
I am saying no at least 2 to 3 times a week to stuff because I want to, at this age, I want to own it. I don't want there to be any doubt or reservation about what I do. And if there's even a little bit, I just say no to it because I feel like I've earned that luxury.
Sure.
You know?
Yes, you have.
And I've tried to always do that. You know, have that. Whether I deserved it early on or not, I tried to be as discerning as I could. But now I just am. But the only thing I can say that I want to do, but I've got to talk my son into doing it, is I wrote a little book called Propeller One Way Night Coach. I don't know if you've ever seen it or read it. It's a novella. Mm-hmm. And I would love to direct him in that. Maybe Kelly is playing his mother if she wants to, because it's a story that reflects my childhood, but a little boy and his mother that are flying across country in the age where jets were coming out, but there were still propeller airliners, so you had the mix of the two, and it's all the people he meets en route to the West Coast. So it's an ascension. It's a story of ascension and hope, but it's just a mom and her child and the adventures of going across, but has a lot of gravitas and depth because of the conversations that the boy and the mother have en route from New York to LA, because it took, you know, lots of hours to get there. So, and an overnight in Pittsburgh. So, that's the only one that I could tell you that I want to do right now. And it's very interesting to the seduction of going, you know, I believe in artists, but you don't really know what their vision is until you demand it from them. And sometimes they don't have the right words for you. I used to fool myself into, saying, well, you know, give them a shot at this and do that. But you know it when they have it. Like when Fred pitched, I didn't know he could do this, but saw this little other film he did, and he was so brilliant as an actor in it, and his vision of this and his freedom that he was giving me, and I said, I think it's going to work. But that's not all the time. You know, a lot of times people fool you with their vision, or they don't really have one, but they're vamping, you know, And that's hard on you when you say yes to it, and they don't want to come to the game with the ideal scene for this. So I guess I'm being more picky than ever, you know, now.
So you wrote the book, you know, the children's book that we're discussing. And then is there any future plans to write something maybe that you have your vision to put out there?
No, just this one, because it's the only piece I've ever written. I've written scripts, and you'd be amazed what I've written four scripts, but I've never from scratch. Well, I have a couple of times, but this is really this is all me and all my vision. So that's the one I'm most interested in doing, especially if Ben, he's not totally convinced yet. And I'd like, but I feel like I only have another year and then he'll be too old for it. It should be an 8 to 10 year old, and he's 8 and he's about to turn 9. So I think 9 is perfect. Not too much older, because there's an innocence about it that I have to grasp that needs to be in it. So that's the only thing right now. And I always viewed myself as a muse. I think writers have much better ideas of what I should do than I do. You know, if you'd said to me, play president, if you said play a woman, if you'd said play a hitman, if you had said play any of the angel, I wouldn't have come up with those ideas. But I'm sure good at executing them.
Yeah. Yes.
You know, I don't mind being someone else's muse at all. I'm good at it. I'm just not versed at creating it from scratch, other than this little book I wrote, which is so personal.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's awesome. Listen, John, thanks for coming on the show.
You're so welcome.
It was incredible to be able to just sit down to talk with you about everything we've discussed. I mean, I'm just going to say it, this is a dream come true. Well, so I appreciate this so much.
No one deserves it more than you guys, especially JT specific. You guys rock with that. And I really appreciate the detail and the care in which you articulate your feelings about my work and what I've done, because it's very important to me. And you've granted that importance back to me. So I thank you for so deeply appreciating what I do. And I was actually very excited to do this, and I very, very much wanted to do this. So I'm not here with any favor other than pure joy to be here.
That's awesome for you to say that. Thank you.
It's true.
And I'm extending the invitation for you to come back on the show anytime you want.
Well, this will be whenever I have in the mood for yapping,
yeah,
or telling my feelings about a piece of art or anything. I now I know where I can go.
100%.
Yeah, that's
100%.
Good.
100%. Yeah. Excellent.
It's a joy to have you.
Thank you.
Excellent.
Well, you guys are a joy.
Thank you. All right. And all right, Kristen, thank you as always.
Thank you, Dana.
And my name is Dana Buckler, and thank you so much for listening.